bearing witness, Auschwitz survivors marking 80 years since the liberation of the most notorious Nazi death camp.
We were victims in a moral vacuum.
On International Holocaust Remembrance Day, they urge vigilance against hate.
We are seeing a tsunami of anti-Semitism today in many parts of the world.
Today's Monday, January 27th, and this is The Issue from VOA. Hi, everyone. I'm Lori London. Scott has the day off. Auschwitz survivors gathered with world leaders and European royalty on the 80th anniversary of the Nazi death camp's liberation.
I was then just past my 13th birthday. And when the SS man looked at me, he decided, apparently, that I was fit for slave labor and pointed me in the direction of those surviving. My little brother, aged 9, did not. So he lost his life. He was murdered.
More than 1 million people perished in gas chambers or from starvation, cold, and disease at Auschwitz, where most had been brought in freight wagons packed like livestock. Remaining survivors, now in their 80s and 90s, expressed concerns of rising anti-Semitism and hatred they say they're witnessing in the modern world, and warning not to let history repeat itself.
We were victims in a moral vacuum. But today, however, we have an obligation not only to remember, which is very, very important, but also to warn and to teach that hatred only begets more hatred, killing more killing.
In all, between 1941 and 1945, Nazi Germany and its collaborators systematically murdered 6 million Jews across German-occupied Europe, along with Romani people, sexual minorities, disabled people, and others who offended Nazi ideas of racial superiority. Joining us now is Ambassador Deborah Lipstadt, who served as special envoy to monitor and combat anti-Semitism in the Biden administration and is currently a professor of history and religious studies at Emory University. Thank you very much for taking the time to speak with me.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure.
What are your thoughts on this 80th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz?
It's been eight decades since the camp was liberated. And I never dreamt that I would say we are seeing a tsunami of anti-Semitism today in many parts of the world. I want to be careful. I'm not suggesting we're seeing another Holocaust. I'm not suggesting we're seeing impending genocide. But we're seeing the normalization of anti-Semitism in an unprecedented fashion, unprecedented since 1945.
And so on this day, does that take on more significance as far as remembering to never forget?
Absolutely, it takes on more significance. Absolutely. Remembering is always important. We remember Memorial Day. I'm in Washington. I always go out to Arlington to be there for the ceremony. Remembering is crucial. Remembrance is the, I think, the cornerstone of much of what we build our lives on. But today, given the current situation, remembrance becomes all the more important. I'll tell you why I say that. No genocide, not the Armenian genocide, not the Holocaust, not the Rwandan genocide, Sudan, no genocide begins with guns, machetes, gas chambers, or whatever weapon was used. It always begins with words. And we are seeing words used in a most troubling fashion, anti-Semitic words used and anti-Semitic tropes and anti-Semitic innuendos, and generally far more than just innuendos, used in a much more overt fashion than in a very long time.
Are you seeing this globally, not just limited to the United States?
No. First of all, in my 3 years at the State Department, my remit was, of course, overseas. So I traveled to, 30, 40 different I made many, many country visits. I certainly saw it overseas, but my predecessors, the people who held this position before I did, had the luxury, if one can call it that, to go to these countries and say, you have a problem, and we in the United States are concerned about the rise of anti-Semitism. Because of the situation, I can't do that. I would go and say, we have a problem, you have a problem, and we in the United States have a problem. It's global.
Why do you think this is happening?
I think it's been brewing for a long time. I think many people have used the Gaza war, the conflict in the Middle East since 10/7, as an excuse or a cover for making anti-Semitic remarks, or have expressed their opposition to Israeli policies in overtly anti-Semitic fashion. And let me be very clear here. Criticism of Israeli policies is not anti-Semitism, just like criticism of American policies is not anti-Americanism. That's what a democracy thrives on, you know, critique back and forth. What I'm talking about was when the critics use anti-Semitic tropes, use anti-Semitic imagery, use anti-Semitic rhetoric, make comparisons to Nazism, and question the right of Israel to exist in a way that they question no other country, then I have to say that's not just criticism of policy, that's crossed the line.
It's interesting because a percentage of Americans, it's sort of not something they even really comprehend, that it was so long ago and it's a part of history, but maybe either don't believe it or don't really understand the significance of what happened. And of course, the remaining survivors are now very few and far between, but they're still speaking out. Are they the last voices? How does that carry on?
Well, I think you're absolutely correct on a number of points. First of all, most Americans don't get it. They don't understand that when we're talking about anti-Semitism, we're talking, A, about the longest continuous hatred. B, we're talking about something that is a conspiracy theory that is used to threaten democracy, the rule of law, threaten national stability, used by enemies, bad actors, malign actors to destabilize a society. B, the passage of survivors, yes, when I first started to work in this field, survivors were everywhere. And you could turn to them, you could hear from them, you could debate with them, you could discuss. Now, I know the organizers at Auschwitz were very happy that they could find enough survivors who were strong enough and hardy enough to be able to participate in this very difficult and moving ceremony. But I also am grateful the fact that there is a generation of scholars, of students of this topic, museums, but it has to be taught. People have to be reminded. It can't be thought of as something that happened over there and had nothing to do with us or doesn't apply to us. Anti-Semitism is a shape shifter. It shifts shapes and manages to be injected into societies to cause disruption and hate, and has to be addressed very seriously.
We talked about never forget. If there is this rise in anti-Semitism that you're seeing globally, is the reality that this could happen again?
I'm a historian. I can't predict what might happen again. I mean, of course, after the Holocaust, we thought there wouldn't be another genocide. And then we saw what happened in Rwanda. We saw what happened in Cambodia. So these things do repeat themselves. We see what's happening today in China with the Uyghurs, the Chinese Muslims. So these things can happen again. But I think the most important thing is to remember that, again, as I said earlier, it starts with speech and it starts with normalization of hatred. It starts with putting all the blame on one group, one country, Israel, because Israel has become the international Jew, so to speak. And again, you can criticize Israeli policies. Israelis criticize Israeli policy. But when you begin to use anti-Semitic comments, tropes to declare it's, you know, that this is how Jews behave or Jews are like that or whatever it might be, then you've crossed the line. And I think most of all, we have to be careful with what we say. We have to remember, not in a superficial way, but really try to understand what's going on in our society. And, you know, something may start with the Jews, but it doesn't end there. If the Germans had won the war, many other groups would have been subjected to the same treatment that they meted out to the Jews. They couldn't wait to mete it out to the Jews. They couldn't wait for victory. But had they won, you know, we would have seen a far greater killing of disabled people, people with chronic diseases, of Roma and Sinti, sometimes called gypsies, of other groups. It starts with one group, but it doesn't end there.
All right. Thank you very much for your perspective. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
That was Ambassador Deborah Lipstadt, who served as special envoy to monitor and combat anti-Semitism in the Biden administration and now currently a professor of history and religious studies at Emory University. Meanwhile, as living memory fades, the mission of remembering falls to the next generations and key institutions. For that part of the historical significance, we're joined by Leah Wolfson, Director of Academic Programs with the United States Holocaust Museum. What are your thoughts on this day?
I think today, especially here at the museum, we have survivors stationed throughout the permanent exhibition to greet our visitors and to really talk about different moments in the exhibit that are personal to them. And I think a lot about the survivor generation, which, as we know, is rapidly aging, and how lucky we are to still have them here, how we want to hear their voices as long as we possibly can. But at the same time, how we're also reminded that in this time of rising anti-Semitism, those firsthand voices will not be with us very much longer, which really makes the educational mission of this museum and of so many other Holocaust organizations really all the more important, so that we can continue to carry those important survivor stories and those important voices forward into the future.
The fact that these people are in their 80s and late 90s, and there are only so many left that actually experienced this global tragedy that a stain on the world for so many years. And, you know, there are generations of people that really can't fathom anything like that or think that this could ever happen. One of the themes that we've always heard for many years is never forget. Do you think that message now is even more important to carry on?
The history of the Holocaust is really vast and varied. I think we very often think of it as only being about Auschwitz. And today in particular, we think about Auschwitz because that is, of course, a part of the commemoration today. But there are so many different experiences that encompass what we think of as the Holocaust, right? There's family separation. There's persecution. There's separation from your home. There's so many different parts of that. And I think what our survivor community continues to do so well and what this history continues to teach us are the many different intersections that people can find within their own lives and connections that they can find. And I'm always so impressed when I listen to our survivors on the floors below, in particular today, really finding that point of connection with our visitors, whether they've had any experience that is even remotely close to any particular aspect of the Holocaust or not. So I think there are always connections and resonances to be had, and there are always things to learn. And one of the things that this institution really tries to do very intentionally is to encourage our visitors to have critical thinking about their own role in the world and their own role in their own lives. It's very easy to think of this history as a history of bureaucracy, but this is really a history of 1,000 small choices. It's the history of people who chose to support the Nazis, either overtly or passively. It's also the story of 1,000 choices of people who chose to help in large ways, but also very often in many small ways. So that, to me, is the way this history resonates today. Again, when I think about the history of the Holocaust, I really do think about it, and our institution tries to think about it in ways where, what did it take to make the Holocaust possible, right? It took a level of anti-Semitism to make the Holocaust possible. It took a lot of people turning the other way. It took some people supporting, and it took everything in between. So one of the things that we really try to instill in our visitors is the idea that, again, this is a history of 1,000 different choices along the way, and therefore the choices that we all make on our own lives matter a great deal.
What would you say to people who acknowledge this horrific tragedy and don't want to come to the museum because they feel like it's just too painful to revisit in their minds, even though they didn't personally experience it?
Sure. Well, you know, again, I think there's always the idea that the Holocaust the history of the Holocaust is a pile of dead bodies, right? And I keep thinking about what is one of the most powerful installations here at the museum, which is our Tower of Faces that I was in earlier today. It's portrait photographs, floor-to-ceiling portrait photographs from one particular small town. And they're people living their lives in all of the ways in which we live our lives. Some of them are, you know, formal portraits. Some of them are snapshots on a winter day. There's a photo of someone with Mickey Mouse ears on. There are all kinds of different experiences. So really, you know, when I think about this history, I don't actually think about piles of dead bodies. I think about individual people and the experiences that those individual people had, and that it is our responsibility to honor those people and honor their voices and honor their stories in whatever way we can.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you so much.
That was Professor Leah Wolfson, Director of Academic Programs with the United States Holocaust Museum. And you've been listening to The Issue from The Voice of America. On behalf of Scott Walterman and all of us here at VOA, thank you so much for joining us. You can follow The Issue on X, Blue Sky, and Facebook at VOA The Issue. And for news 24 hours a day, check out our website, voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Lori London. We'll talk to you tomorrow.